This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, my name is Brandon Sword. I'm a host on the art channel of New Books Network. I am excited to be here today talking to Sandra Johnston, Brian Patterson, and Alistair McLennan about a new publication coming out from Intellect Books that is providing an overview of a lot of McLennan's performance work over the past couple decades. So one of the things that I was struck by perusing this book is how a lot of McLennan's work was made during the Troubles, this like period of unrest in Northern Ireland. And I was thinking about the current political moment we find ourselves in with Brexit and the possibility of like a reestablishment of this like hard border along the Irish Anglo the border between Northern and Southern Ireland. So I was kind of curious about like how the current political climate in the United Kingdom like influenced this book at all, or if you thought about that as you were going through all of this work and putting it together.
Sandra, I think you should take that one.
Okay. Well, Brandon, I think, yes, the book is grounded in McLennan's practice in the 1970s and 80s during the worst atrocities of the Troubles. And certainly that that forms the baseline for really sort of understanding the evolution of his practice, but then also as the book progresses and in the different chapters, you'll see how it then kind of migrates into different contexts. And, you know, we're speaking today in the midst of local elections and, you know, in the background on the TV in the kitchen downstairs, there's a lot of kind of consternation and debate going on because like Northern Ireland continues to be in a state of precarity. And I think, the United Kingdom, Scotland, for sure, there's issues of independence that will revive ongoingly, and today's elections will certainly bring forward closer debate around dissolving the border of Ireland and the border between the north and the south. So I feel like Alistair's practice has huge relevance not just to Northern Ireland, but it's always had huge relevance to the kind of whole cultural picture across the UK and Ireland, and the way that these islands and these nations are closely knit together in very kind of contentious and complex ways. So, yes, I mean, there's, particularly in the introduction, we're laying out the real value of the work in that the work Alistair made in Belfast in the 1970s, it's really very, it stands out on its own. Nobody else was making performative practice, certainly not in public space and certainly not in full view of retaliation and consequences. So the idea of causality is very, very strong in Alistair's practice, and that's been consistent the whole way through the 50 years that we are representing.
Yeah, yeah. And it's like a lot of these issues, they're not like limited to the United Kingdom and Ireland. It's like an American who didn't follow British politics very closely, it's like Brexit really hit me like it was like a ton of bricks. And then now, you know, it's like we had the election of Donald Trump in the US, Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil, like the recent Macron-Le Pen election in France, and like in France especially, it's like a huge like part of that was these like political kind of like questions of Europe, the European Union. So it's like these like similar themes, but they manifest in these like really specific contexts. So it's like, obviously it's like the relationship between the United Kingdom and Ireland goes back like hundreds of years.
Well, I think it's important to say too, in relation to performance art practice, that often people feel that if it deals with politics, that it has to do it through big symbols and kind of like very obvious metaphors, you know. And I think, you know, what's again something that's extraordinary about Alistair's practice is this poetical quality, and that's why we titled the main title of the book is Actional Poetics, which picks up on the fact that, yes, there's an undercurrent of reaction and responsiveness and a relation almost to actionism and that history of performance art. But just kind of keying into that word of poetics and the idea that you can do it through ambiguity, you can do it through speculation, rather than feeding people obvious kind of literal information and sort of putting them back in that position of feeling oppressed by an artwork because they feel like they're being told more of the same, you know. So I feel like Alistair's work is really important because it never falls into that trap of preaching. It's not about a doctrine. But I mean, Alistair, you can say it much better than I can.
Yeah, because it's always opening it up, like, you know, more so than, you know.
It's seeing although I lived in, I've come to Northern Ireland in 1975 and basically been living here since then, but traveling a lot in different countries and making performances and so on. And I'm intrigued by sameness within difference within sameness, you know, in terms of religion, politics, and social conditions in so many different countries, you know, and there's different variations and combinations, but very often there's the same underlying issues. And if you want problems of binary thinking rather than holistic thinking, I'm interested in the specificity of this in different countries, but at the same time, not wanting to get locked into just limiting the how and the what of the work to the specifics of only one country or one situation, you know, trying to find, if you want, the local within the universal and the universal within the local. Mm. Yeah. The notion of finding a continent within a fossil and a fossil within a continent. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, this seems like a potentially really fraught of like how to like make work within a context that you have varying degrees of familiarity with. So you have, you know, like Roland Barthes, we were talking about France already, but writes mythologies about French culture and is like a really like brilliant book. And then he tries to write a similar book about like Japan, and it doesn't do very well. He doesn't have the same kind of like familiarity with like these other cultures. I don't know if this is something you think about or like worry about. You talked a little bit about it in terms of this, like finding similar themes and finding like particular in a universal in a particular.
Well, again, there's like layers of an onion, you know, and in spiritual, religious, political, social situations, you can deal with surface layers or varying underlying layers. And you can begin to interfuse the layers also. And you can play with purposively ambiguities and pluralities of association so that viewers won't just see the work and think, oh, that's that. You know, like a one-liner, wanting them to actually try to sense and trust their own intuition as to what perhaps this combination of aspects is conveying to them. And you want them to trust their own intuition with regard to what they're experiencing. Not just knowledge, but direct intuition, you know? I want to work with emotions, the intellect, but intuition also, you know?
Yeah, there's I'm kind of thinking about performance as a medium, as being kind of caught in between or sharing in both like visual art, but also like theater, and how I feel like in visual art land, there is a much greater like tolerance for like ambiguity in ambivalence than maybe there is in theater. Maybe I'm being an unsympathetic. We have very radical stuff within theater. We have Beckett, we have, but it's like if in the visual art world, it's like if someone's work is kind of like too readily digestible or something, it's like you might call someone's work like superficial or like decorative, depending on the medium. Whereas like in theater, it's like, at least in kind of mainstream theater, if it's like, you know, if we don't understand like why a character is doing something, that's like a problem potentially that has to be solved. So I come from like a theater background, and I like work in performance. So like I think about this a lot. I don't know if you like think about these things or if you've had like either like training, exposure, experience, if you keep up with theater or these debates?
Well, I mean, a big factor of that is where the work is placed. And I think, you know, where performance art happens and the fact that so much of Alistair's work happens in the street, but not just casually, you know, it's very precise. And I think a lot of performance art has this site specificity. And the power of place and the all of the information that an audience is collecting and attuning to whenever they're in a specific location. I think that's a huge part of what's potent about performance art, that you're not putting people into a precious building necessarily, and you're not giving them all those trappings and expectations that create passivity. So it's like, I mean, I've often seen Alistair perform in situations of real jeopardy, where it felt like, incredibly risky, what was happening. And then also that over very, very long durations. So I'm thinking, for example, of a 24-hour performance in a tiny village in the north of Poland in 1994, where, you know, Alistair was performing within an installation that he constructed in a public square. And during the night, it got really volatile, really, really aggressive. And, you know, at several points, it felt as if the installation was going to be, there was going to be a rupture and a kind of like breaking through. But what I find personally extraordinary is that time and time again, the work actually pushes into this kind of like nervous system of tolerance and this idea of how and what we accept and under what rules and what of permission. You know, so I think the work really acutely looks at why, you know, these kinds of these ideas of trespassing, these ideas of ownership, and those layers that Alistair's talking about, that if you, you know, if you position it inside the museum with a big plaque beside it and you give it endless explanation, then yes, it does become pacified and its meanings become entrenched. But I think like a lot of the volatility comes from the use of space, which is certainly something that I learned as a practitioner from Alistair.
Yeah.
And using public space, where people walking down the street might come upon something and think, what the heck is this? Do you know what I mean? Because, and wanting them to think and try to get a sense over time as to what this might be conveying and be about.
Yeah, it's I'm the interviewer, not the interviewee, but I'd like to tell a short story. So I'm a PhD candidate in sociology, and there is a sociologist named Harold Garfinkel who would do these things he called breaching experiments, where people would violate social norms and see what would happen. So they would like go into an elevator, and then rather than everyone, normally in an elevator everyone turns to face the door, so they would go in and not face the door, they would face the people in the elevator and try and make eye contact with them. Or they would go to the store and buy something and they're like, oh, it comes to $4.49. And they're like, okay, but I want to give you like $10 for it. And they're like, no, it costs $4.49. And they're like, I understand, but I think this is really great and I want to give you. And people like break down like very quickly. And it kind of shows, I was telling this to like an art history professor, and he was like, oh, I didn't know sociologists made performance art. And it's kind of similar, where there's like, it's the kinds of laws, the unspoken rules and assumptions that like govern like what social space, like what's acceptable and not acceptable to do. Even in like museum context, like I've done museum interventions with like a friend of mine, and I don't know what it's like in Europe. In the US, you start doing something weird in a museum and everyone is like, what are you doing? Why are you doing that? It's like when you've come to the place to where you is designed to for you to encounter things that you don't understand, you're like, what's the explanation? Why are you doing this? I'm reminded of kind of this, like the kind of fragility and also like endurance of a lot of these social norms that navigate, like especially the way we use public space.
But one wants to work to question perimeters and to question fixity. You know, yeah.
I mean, it's been interesting in Northern Ireland how it's expanded out through Be Beyond. And in a way, we've really sort of taken the example of Alistair's practice and also some other practitioners, particularly like Boris Nilsoni in Cologne in Germany. And this idea of open sessions and working collectively, so that it's not just one isolated individual artist, but that idea of a kind of collective action. But Brian can say more.
Yeah, it's because taking just what Sandra was saying there, just taking on that idea from the idea of black market, and Alistair's part of the black market people too as well. And so, you know, Be Beyond have set up doing what we call just Performance Monthly. It was just a rather descriptive term, like, you know, because it was, you know, looking for a name for what do we call it. So we've done performances every month from 2008, from the summer solstice, like, you know. So that's a kind of an ongoing thing. So, and that's very interesting, just, you know, going into a public space and just making these performances, like, and so there's no there's no rehearsal. It's just kind of improvised performances, and where sometimes like constellations come along and whatever, like, but it's very interesting what the people, the general public, kind of come up come upon it, like, and they think, some people think, oh look, they just let them all out of the asylum in one day or something, that's what they can. But you know, people are coming around to saying, I remember one guy at a meeting, like, you know, one time we had in 2008, like, you know, and he basically came, or no, it was after, it was about 2012, he basically come to me and he said, like, you know, because at that day there was another protest march in Belfast against racism, like, out there. And then he basically come up to me and he said, you know, and we were talking in the performance, and then he, you know, I want to go to shake hands and he wanted a big hug, like, and he says, look, you guys are doing no harm to no one, like, you know. But it was just this kind of openness, like, you know, that and the playfulness, like, you know, that we kind of, that allowed kind of the situation to kind of open. And that's kind of, I was thinking about that term, the actional poetics, like, you know, whereas, you know, the poetry kind of opens things, like, you know, so. So it's like opening the space for others as well, like, you know, so it's what they bring to it, you know.
Yeah, sometimes in a Be Beyond situation, there may be, you know, there can sometimes be a number of individuals who come, and I mean, what we've maybe pre-agreed is the time of the group performance and where we'll do it. And individuals can come with some materials for the performance if they wish, or no materials, and none of us knows what the others are going to be doing or not doing. But there's it's based on a kind of trust and the notion of, you know, one's own self-discipline as an artist, but also being prepared to be flexible and adaptable as to what seems appropriate in relation to others who are there.
Yeah. One of the, I think this relates to one of the other issues I want to talk about, which was like authorship. So I think that both in art world and like literary worlds, it's, we're sort of attached to the idea of like an individual author, which can like cause problems perhaps when you have work that is very like collaborative or open or public. Like, how do we like know like what like is and isn't someone's work? So it's like, for like in film, we have this like this auteur theory of that it's like the film kind of like artistically belongs to the director. Like, so it's like a Roman Polanski film. It's a David Lynch film. It's a Godard film. Even though there's like dozens, hundreds of other people who are, whose labor and effort is going into like making that possible. So I was, or even like with, when I write something and I've, it's like, I'm the person, you know, like sitting in front of my word processor, like hitting the keys, but it's like their arguments, ideas that I've developed, like by talking to other people, by in conversation with editors and professors and mentors and so many others. And then it comes out with like my name on it, but it feels both like appropriate and inappropriate or something. Or if any thoughts about how that kind of individual collective played out, either in your practice, Alistair, or in how the publication came together?
Well, I started out as a very traditional academic painter, you know, oil paintings of portraits and so on, and very traditional, very academic and so forth. But I found certain real limitations within that. And just like plants grow from the inside out, we're not just looking at them. They don't just grow from the outside in, from the inside out, and wanting to make art that evolved from the inside and manifesting outwardly, but also wanting to question the perimeters again of authorship. You know, for instance, maybe you might get some musicians who, for instance, they play their instruments very skillfully, very well, but they might like getting coming together and improvising, like in jazz, you know, certain forms of jazz. And a question I would have would be, so why can't painters, instead of just doing their own individual painting, doing that as well, but why not several of painters getting together and making a work that interfuses the creativity, the painterly creativity of several people making one work, and so they can share authorship, if you want, of the work. If musicians can do it, why can't visual artists also do it? So again, raising the question of the parameters of authorship.
And it's a bit more like real life too as well, you know, because it's engaging with it, like, you know, so it's not just kind of a closed situation where somebody's directing it, like, you know, there's no, there's no like lead author, you know.
I'm reminded, I recently watched the Andy Warhol documentary on Netflix, where there are these collaborations he does with Basquiat, where they are like painting together. And it's really funny where it's like Basquiat's this like younger artist and he's like painting over like Warhol stuff, like he doesn't, in very different styles. But it sort of works together, but it's also, it is very uncommon. And it's someone like Warhol who, it's like the basis of his career is kind of like this collective, you know, it's like he would get a book deal and put a tape recorder in the factory and like record conversations and then like send it off to be typed up and have that be the manuscript. He's very much like a setting up a space within which like the factory people can do things.
I think there's something to be said about Northern Ireland again, and particularly Belfast as a context. There's a huge amount of artist-led organizations, and that's been the case since the early 90s. But even before that, Alistair was one of the founders of Arts Research Exchange, which was funded by Joseph Boyce, and there is there is this legacy, I think, for us as artists to look at like non-hierarchical models. Now, of course, you can critique that because organizations very quickly do cement into like a set of rules, and to some extent an ethos is necessary. You know, there has to be something that people congregate and agree around. But I think, like, you know, we've all traveled a lot as artists, and I feel like Northern Ireland, and perhaps it is to do with the consequence of the Troubles and a deep conservatism that ruled the art world, to the extent that experimentation was really completely unfunded and most artists were completely like blacklisted, you know, right up through until the 90s. So I feel like this you know, and interestingly, the Turner Prize was won last year by Array Studios, a collective from Belfast. So it's something that we've really engendered and we've really inhabited and explored in a serious way, this idea of working non-hierarchically and sharing resources and sharing talent and sharing, you know, sharing vision, actually.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I would have noticed when I came in 1975 to Belfast was that teaching in the art college, fine art, but once the students finished, I noticed they seemed to disappear and you never heard about them again or saw their work or whatever. And in my experience of being in America and Canada and living in Canada for a few years, in the East Coast and then the West Coast, I became very aware of how the Canada Council was very, very supportive of artist-run organizations and the real benefits in this, you know, so that when I came here, I thought, why, it would be good if we could get group studios for students who graduated, who'd finished, so that they could keep their practice going if they were working at part-time jobs and so they would still have a space to go to where they could do their engage their creativity and also maybe have a gallery space within the studios, you know, so that they wouldn't be totally dependent on very, very limited official gallery spaces for their work. And so we had a meeting at Art and Research Exchange, and then we tried to, there was also no art magazine dealing with contemporary art at the time, you know, experimental work. And so we managed to get an art magazine developed, Circa Art Magazine, dealing with contemporary issues, art issues in Ireland. And then we got group studio spaces set up. And then, you know, the notion also of the benefit of having one foot within the art establishment and one foot without it, out with it, so that you could use the street as your studio and also your gallery. And one of the things about performance is if you've very, very little money and you can't buy expensive art materials, you can use your body as the material. Yeah? And in the street, you don't have to get some gallery curator to give you an exhibition. You can give it yourself in public space. And okay, take responsibility for how and what you do in that situation. No?
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, I feel like there's a way that we, or at least I, associate performance with kind of like moments of like political like unrest, because it's like, you know, even in, you know, like the Soviet Union or something, when a lot of ways of making art become like outlawed, it's like, well, you like always have like a body, and until you don't anymore, but you usually have a body. And thinking about the parallels between like I talked about, like performance art versus theater, and then performance art versus or and alongside with protest. So like you talk about like site specificity and these performances in public, which is also, you know, it's like most, if not all cities have places like this that have significance that people gather in. I'm thinking like there's the Los Madres de la Plaza de Mayo, the mothers of the Mayo Plaza in Argentina, who it's every Sunday for like years, the mothers of all of these desaparecidos, people who were disappeared under the Videla dictatorship. I get the dictators confused. In Argentina, it's like they dress in white and they have pictures of their their loved ones, like continuing to like seek information about like their just like anything. So there's this way that it's like performance and like bodies, protests, these are ways of like actualizing like potential within a space, Like, I spend a lot of time thinking about Latin America, where many cities are built around like plazas that are kind of specifically for this purpose of people to kind of like manifest, and also like performance as a way of like keeping something like in memory. So this is also something that it's like in, I'm in Los Angeles right now, where the city's had a history of kind of like, you know, sometimes they'll like literally pave over like a place that used to be like a site of like remembrance or something. And like performance as like a way of like keeping things like in memory, like making, like reliving them, keeping them present. If you guys feel that at all.
Yeah, I would agree strongly with that. I think there is a very strong sensibility of aftermath, not just in Alistair's work, but in a lot of Irish performance art. And a friend of ours has just finished a PhD on perpetrator identity, and actually sort of exploring the fact that the you know, who we are when we're performing is multiple, like, and we're not necessarily the innocent or the victim, you know. So I think there's actually I really respect his research, because he opens up that potentiality that when you're performing, you're sifting through like a number of identities, and that also does relate to who you are, where you are, you know. I think back to your sort of earlier question, that for when I'm traveling, I'm often uncomfortable with the fact that, you know, you're flying in for a very short amount of time, and you bring ignorance with you. You know, there's so much that you can't fill in, or you can't superficially, you know, pretend to have a kind of body of knowledge that you don't. So you have to do the best with what you have, and a kind of humility as well. But I think that performance art, and particularly the kind of manner of Alistair's work, it often does manifest into a sense of a vigil, or a sort of sense of a ceremony, that something is being marked and something is being held, but also that it is being done in a very respectful way. So it's always interesting to me how, you know, like a random audience can relate to something that's happening over several hours, and the way that they change in response to it, because first of all, they can just glimpse it, and it can be quite flippant, or it can be, you know, quite abrasive, you know. But then over time, you know, as people go by, or equally, if you're making performance in a hospital or some kind of situation where you're very still within a lot of flux, a lot of activity, I've often had people come up to me at the end of a performance, and you know, it's the cleaner, it's the caretaker, it's the person who's the real gatekeeper, who actually notices you, you know, and notices what it is that is happening, that is, you know, kind of creating a sort of dissonance in otherwise the kind of habitual sort of behavior that happens there. So I think, like as Alistair was saying, there's a responsibility when you're putting yourself into these positions. It's not casual. And how it plays out is so much to do with the way in which you conduct yourself, and the way in which you are also open and receptive to the impact it may be having, you know. So it's this kind of reciprocal thing that is set in motion that I think just makes it kind of like fascinating to make this kind of work.
But it's also you. When you travel and you see, I'm fascinated by just the sense of people on the street, how they are. You know, just very often you can get a sense of a town, a village, a city, a place, just from the aura, the atmosphere in the street, but how people are, how they behave. You can, and I'm interested in making work that has a kind of an empathy with difficulty that many members of the public are going through. Ordinary, very ordinary, everyday, real situations they're living through, and maybe trying to, maybe not writing poetry about this, but with the visual aspect, you're trying to make visual poetics, visual poetry, using one's body, if you want, as the material, maybe some other materials in relation to the body, how one is in a space in relation to others. And for me, the art, the heart of it is in the quality of interrelations, the quality of that. For me, that's at the heart of the art. And that one's trying to engage that ongoingly, moment by moment, while making the work. And you don't have the security, if you're doing it outside someplace necessarily, that you might feel within a gallery, although I do some work in galleries as well, you know, and so on, and sometimes in a museum, but often in public space, because there's a sense of the unpredictable also, you know, and being able to find how to embrace that and allow that to become part of the work, to allow the form of it, the work to be flexible enough to engage with specifics in the locality, the public space where one happens to be. Not to compromise the work, to keep the core principle of the work, but to allow the form of it to be adaptable to specifics that are taking place that one couldn't perhaps foresee necessarily, but to include what's happening moment by moment, ongoingly.
Mm-hmm. It's like there was like a bit in what I read of the book where it kind of talks about your relationship or like interest in like the like I Ching and like Buddhism, and I was kind of I don't know if you have anything you want to say about that. It seems like for a lot of artists who were working in kind of like the mid late 20th century, it's like also a lot of artists in the US also had a lot of those interests. I think in the US we're inclined to think of that as maybe coming out of like the 60s and like counterculture, or I don't know how you like think about that or.
Well, yeah, I became aware of that in the late 60s. I was a student at the Art Institute in Chicago. And, you know, that was a really important and 2-year experience for me. Yeah. And it was a time of minimalism. And I was playing with the notion of the fullness of emptiness and the emptiness of fullness, you know, and so on. And a friend suggesting it sounds a bit like Zen, and so I started reading up on that and so on. But I think a lot of the work in the States at the time, you know, with the Zen, people were interested in the philosophy. You know, some artists became interested in, you know, in New York and so on. But not many did the actual Zazen meditation. And I remember going out, moving from Chicago to Nova Scotia, then going out to Vancouver a few years later. And my interest in Zen had developed, and I went to Rinzai Zen retreats, where they'd give you koans, like a problem, mental problem to work on. How do you realize your true nature while painting? For instance, I got that one from there. And it took me 2 years to actually pass through this, you know, because it only came about through exhausting the intellect, examining all aspects of how to realize one's true nature. You had to manifest it physically, actually, not just talk it. You had to be it. And one only passed it and got official, you know, acceptance and clarity for having realized it after one had completely exhausted all thought and conceptual thinking, not ignoring it, but moving beyond it, like stepping up beyond the top step of the ladder and moving on. And that's when I realized one could use one's own total being as art material, as no separation between the artist and the artwork. Now, it's one thing to know this conceptually, and it's a different thing altogether to realize it experientially. And although in the States and in Canada, Zen was influential in the 60s and 70s, I think most of the artists never went through this actual physical, visceral experience, but stayed on the conceptual level. And the effects of that have affected me ever since, up until the present. It's still the core of my practice.
Yeah, it seems like there's sort of like a parallel between that in like a different way in the present where, you know, we can think about like artists as being like coextensive with their work. Think about people like Boys in this regard. But we also are in this moment, we're not just like performance artists, but it's like all artists. It's like we, perhaps partially because of like social media, that it's like people's lives are like very visible. And there's this kind of this, what we might cynically call the creation of kind of like a personal like brand or something, that it's like all of your stuff can be gathered and kind of like has like coherence as like you. And it's, I feel like this just has been happening like younger and younger. Like I had like first year college students recently who have like websites with like all their stuff. And I'm like, you're like 18. It's like, you don't need to be marketing yourself or trying to like create this image of yourself like so early on. But I think through like professionalization and other like the rise of kind of MFA programs in the US, there's been like a big push on this like professionalization, which it seems kind of like the maybe like the dark side of like what you're talking about, that it's like there's like a coextensiveness between you and your work, and that can have this like that can be like a really like enlightening realization, and it can also be a kind of like depressing realization, like depending on how you go about it.
Well, there's a massive gap between appearance and actuality. A lot of what happens in social media for me is just utterly vacuously superficial. And people are so seduced by it. I sometimes get a train back from a studio I work in, and there's maybe 15 people waiting for the train. About 12 of them are hooked over like that, not paying attention to where they are, how they are in relation, but on their little phones. And I think people think that they're using the technology, but to me, the technology is using them, and they're seduced by it and conditioned and manipulated. And I can see what's happening to our species. And for me, this is not, this is no realization. This is simply utter manipulative it's evidence of manipulation of our species. And we're doing it to ourselves. We need to wake up. How something looks is not how it is. Capital IS. Being is from the inside out, not just the outside in. Making performance art is not easier than being in a studio doing an oil painting. Your life can be at risk. You can get your throat cut.
Yeah, this is also something I was thinking about, that I feel like in performance art, there's this Well, with all art, it happens to a degree of this kind of like transgressive chic or something that, or like endurance type works where it's like there are like, this is something like there's an angry teenager inside of me. And it's like, whenever I see that like transgressive stuff, there's a part of me that is like, yes, like transgress, like break these boundaries. Like, why do they exist? But then we also think it's like to produce good, like art, it's like maybe transgressing boundaries is like part of it, maybe even a necessary part of it, but it's not like just because you break a boundary doesn't to me necessarily mean that it's like art or that it's beautiful. It kind of arcs back to what we were talking about, like about poetics and like the title of the book. So yeah, maybe if we want to have anything else to say about that, or.
Well, it's the quality of interrelations that, for instance, in doing, I love doing the traditional oil painting and so on. And I was doing very well as a student, you know, I was getting top marks and all this kind of, you know, whatever, but I felt there was a hollowness about external skill and dexterity. And so I was wanting to get something more earthy and real coming through from the inside out. You can see, you can hear certain equivalences of what I'm suggesting in music, in sound, of different forms of music, different kinds of sound. And the art, again, residing for me in the quality of interrelations. And who made the rules about what constitutes art materials? Why is oil paint regarded as art material, but dust on a tabletop not regarded as art material? You know, I want to question all the rules and all the theories and the philosophies. Rules are made not only to be obeyed, but to be broken. But one has to assume responsibility for how one is in relation to other at all levels. What does it mean to be a human being alive? For me, this is a major issue. How does one assume responsibility for being alive in relation to others? How can one live one's life where one can feel that one's being of benefit to self in relation to others?
Yeah, I mean, those are questions that they go far beyond like performance or what we might call art. It's like these are kind of like the bedrock, like ethical, you know, since Greece, like how should I live in the world? Like, how should I conduct myself? How should I relate to others?
Yeah. But I would maybe from the various ups and downs and knocks and blows and different kinds of things I would have experienced throughout my life so far, these are the issues I would want to have manifest in the art I make.
I think it's important to say too that a number of the chapters, I mean, all of the chapters are written by people who have experienced Alistair's work on a very deep level and over a very long period of time. So that we prioritized practitioners and we prioritized people that have that kind of quality of having witnessed the work. And I used the word, you know, deliberately. And within all of that, there's also a very important like layer of thinking around pedagogy and unorthodox teaching and that way of kind of you know, taking apart the institution to a certain extent, not necessarily through anarchic kind of like ranting, but through a sort of decentering of where the focus lies in terms of what the teaching is seeking to achieve. So I think, you know, Alistair continues to teach workshops across the world, and certainly within the Ulster University. The teaching had a very sort of profound impact because of this quality of almost like looking underneath the table or looking behind the door, you know, refusing to just comply to the idea of like fabrication and perfection. So I think that a kind of ethos of care is something that comes through perhaps from the 60s and from the Zen thinking as well, an idea of care for self and care for others being intrinsic to how the work functions in the world.
I mean, that seems like as good a place as any to like to wind down our conversation. I just had one blurb I wanted to read for our friend Karen Little, who's responsible for us coming together. So perhaps it's appropriate to end with her. At the online public performance symposium, Flow Embody Insight 2022, registered attendees will receive a 30% discount to this new monograph, Actional Poetics, As She He, The Performance Actuations of Alistair MacLennan, 1971-2020, edited by Sandra Johnston, Sherry Driver, and Paula Blair, in addition to the live art monograph catalog by Intellect Books. Out of Sight is thrilled to partner with Intellect Books at this online symposium and Experimental Sound Studio for a second year. To register for this online public performance art symposium, please visit flowsymposium.org. The symposium includes 4 practice-based workshops in public performance art practices, 11 performative lectures or an artist presentations with the opportunity to perform in week 3. Sandra Johnston, Alistair MacLennan, and Brian Patterson will also be in discussion about this new book on June 17th, 18th, and 19th, there will be a free public performance weekend that will be hosted on Experimental Sound Studios' Twitch TV channel, experimentals_sound_studio. So thank you all for taking the time to talk to me today. And I look forward to seeing this in print.
Thank you.